early 70s, one of his ships was actually in dry dock in Portland, Oregon, long enough that he actually was able to, he purchased a condominium to live in. And so my wife in the early 70s and I, and also brought my mom up, we visited my brother and really liked it up here. And I kind of knew at that point in time that we would eventually make the move to the Northwest. Mm-hmm. My wife, Rosemary, was born in a housing project in West Los Angeles, public housing project, not born, but raised. She's Chicana, grew up with a lot of Latinos and Blacks. And so moving to Oregon, it was like, what? So we made the move in the late 70s and been in Eugene ever since. And very involved in the community, especially my wife, Rosemary, in the Latino community, and myself in the Asian American community in Eugene and statewide, actually.
Yeah, so we mentioned a little about your education background already. Besides your executive director position with Disorient Asian American Film Festival, can you share with us about your education background? So how well was your college and university that prepared you for your teaching profession today?
Sure. Being, the son of an immigrant and also the son, meaning my mom, who didn't have much formal education and it wasn't taught very much. I'm going to guess she probably did not graduate high school. It was never really talked about. And my father, he came here at 17. I'm going to guess his formal education ended at equivalent to maybe sixth grade. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that they were not smart and intelligent. It just means their formal education. And so a couple things encouraged me to go on to college. My brother was already in the military at the time. Mm-hmm. And this was the height of the Vietnam War. And one of his ships was stationed off the shore of Vietnam and doing what they needed to do related to the war in Vietnam. And he advised me, you don't want to do this. You don't want to come into the war. And at the time, there was a lottery system. Mm-hmm. And a lottery system meant that you were going to go in eventually. And so to postpone all of that, a lot of the kids I grew up with, we went on to college. And so I found myself at UCLA, and then UCLA ended, got my bachelor's degree, and I was literally on my way to Vietnam, but some things intervened, including a graduate program that I found just basically on a bulletin board. It was a two-year program through the University of Southern California. In parallel to that, I was able to actually not go to Vietnam due to some medical issues that I didn't even know until I had a thorough exam. And so I was exempt from the draft or going into the military, went on to University of Southern California, and we were in a program called Teacher Corps. It was a two-year federally funded program, which is unheard of today. Tuition was paid for. We got a living stipend of $360 a month. And in those years, I had thought, like they say, that expression, died and gone to heaven. Because as a student at UCLA, I was like scrounging. But when I got $360 a month to pay rent and gas and everything, I was just like, you know, living
the good
high
life.
On the hog. Yeah, living the good life, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it was that two-year program, mm-hmm. to this day, because I've been involved in, as you know, after you saw some of my biographical information, I've been involved in all aspects of K-12 and higher ed, almost, mm-hmm. you know, several different kinds of positions. And I keep looking back at that two-year experience, and I just need to mention two names, Dr. William Tikhonov and Dr. Patricia Heffernan Cabrera. They were instrumental in developing a teacher training program that, from my perspective to this day, would hold water against any current teacher training program. It was bilingual. My Spanish is pretty good. They had intensive language training, which increased my Spanish. We worked with a lot of Latino and migrant youth in the schools. And at the end of that two-year program, we received a teaching credential, a master's in bilingual education, and also a special certificate to work with. In those days, they called them ESL kids. And so from there, and then also way back, the story begins when I was helping my friend deliver papers when I was in elementary school. And we would drive by these mailboxes, and they'd have their names of the people on the mailbox, and we'll go Dr. and Mrs. Jones, mm-hmm. Dr. and Mrs. Smith. And I kept saying doctor, doctor. And I said, what are all those doctors? You know, I thought medical doctors. He said, no, no, those aren't medical doctors, all of them. Those are people who go on and get a PhD. He mm-hmm. knew about that.
Did you know about a PhD degree then?
I did not know. I didn't even know when I went on to college what that meant, meaning the bachelor's degree mm-hmm. or the master's and that whole hierarchy of degrees. And, you know, my brother was gone. My parents didn't know. And so in those years, my friends and us were just, you know, really not sure what all of that college life meant mm-hmm. and the benefits of it. And so when we moved to Eugene, I began to investigate PhD programs, and I knew what it would take. Actually, the PhD program that I really wanted to go into was actually in my hometown, University of California, Santa Barbara, but there was no way. So luckily, Dr. Rob Proudfoot, Native American professor at the University of Oregon, he sought me out, and he was looking for people to form basically, in those days, they didn't use the word cohort the way it's used today, but really it was a cohort of people to go into a doctoral program mm-hmm. in teacher education, specifically curriculum and instruction, and taking a look at multicultural issues and what we would call today equity, diversity, inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so the focus of my work on my PhD was around that. And then during my PhD, actually, I started teaching at the U of O. And then when I finished my PhD, I began teaching some classes, continued at the University of Oregon, Lane Community College, Northwest Christian University, as mm-hmm. well as Oregon State, Western Oregon University, mostly in teacher training, classes having to do with how do you work with students who do not have English as a first language? How do you work with students who have a different background, immigrant background, or students of color, that kind of a thing? And then I started teaching, I developed some courses at Lane Community College around ethnic studies, specifically the Asian American Pacific Islander experience. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I'm still teaching those classes up at Lane.
So moving on, next topic, the Disorient Asian American Film Festival of Oregon.
Sure.
Tell me about it. What was the inspiration
sure.
behind
okay.
it?
Mm-hmm. I think it's always great to look at the historical perspective, but then also there are some other factors and variables, I believe, that came into play in its development. There's a friend and colleague of mine by the name of Jason Mack. I think Kyle, you might know him. He was also on the APONA board for a
yes.
while.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually the founder of Disorient. And so I wasn't necessarily one of the founding members, but I was engaged from the get-go with Disorient. And so Jason was executive director for the first 5 years. And then he had a baby, and the baby was growing, and so he took me out to lunch and basically, do I have a deal for you? How about you taking it over on someone? So that's how it happened. Mm-hmm. So we're coming up to our ninth year. I've been the executive director for 4 years, and another key person is Pamela Kwan. She's associate director. She's been involved also for many years, and she and I coordinate almost everything with a whole group of other volunteers. And it's just an incredible experience. And I use the word experience. It's mm-hmm. more than just a film festival.
So who can participate in these film festivals?
Sure. Again, anyone can come to the films, and we want people to come to the films. And the purpose of Disorient, as Jason laid out the groundwork, it's based on the work of W.E. Du Bois, the voice of who's a very, in history, a very famous African-American activist. And the standard that we use to select films is by us, for us, or about us. And really what that's about is that if you look at independent film festivals, most of them have a, like a niche. And the niche being that oftentimes Hollywood will not pick up these films. So that's one piece or one variable. The second thing is that, especially with the younger generations, independent film or film in general is a way that a lot of people are expressing themselves. Asian American Pacific Islander people are expressing themselves. They have a story to tell through film because it's very, very powerful. And so the process we plan, basically it's a year-long planning process, even though it's a 3 or 4 day film festival in the spring. We open up submissions in the fall, usually around September, October. I'll just simply describe it as an online process. Okay. And people submit, and then Pam, who's basically in charge of that submission process, gets the films, and we usually get anywhere from 70 to 90 films in during the fall. And she sets up a committee that screens them. Again, it's just not one person selecting the films. Mm-hmm. They view the films and make the selection. And it's really hard because there's so many great films out there, but our limitation is time. Right. In other words, if it's a three, if we had a 9 day festival, we can get them all in, but we don't. Mm-hmm. And so, so usually we show or screen between, I'll say between 22 to 30 films, and they are all independent films, meaning, the filmmaker or the director are basically almost funding it themselves on a shoestring. And I say that in a positive way, actually. And they come from all over the United States. We've had a filmmaker submit one from Italy, actually, and Canada also. But again, we're clear that it's about the Asian American and Pacific Islander experience. And either the filmmaker or the actors or the subjects are Asian American or Pacific Islander. And the theme may not be, but it's their story of how they express themselves. Or we've had filmmakers who are not Asian American or Pacific Islander, but the theme is around our experiences. And so it's been really rich over the years.
So the film festival happened in April.
Yes.
Uh-huh. How many attendees are you guys expecting? Maximum.
Or? The theater, the Bijou Art Cinema Theaters, mm-hmm. it's near the campus, University of Oregon, seats about 110 people. And the last couple of years, we've actually had sellout crowds. So I would encourage people if from the Portland area, and we do get a lot of people from Portland going down for specific films or just for the entire festival, to go online. The schedule will be up in a while, probably soon, the exact schedule of the films that we're bringing in. And so you can pick and choose, and each film has an individual price. However, you can purchase VIP passes that get you in the entire festival for around $50. And part of the VIP pass is that we have a green room, which is like a reception room, mm-hmm. which is, we have a lot of food and drink in there, non-alcoholic, but a lot of food and drink and beverages. And people come in and hang out, and the filmmakers and producers, directors who are around, you get to meet them. And it's a really a neat experience. And that's what I tell people, that Disorient is not only a film festival, it really is an experience. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our regular fans who keep coming back year after year. We have new people coming back. We have partnerships with a lot of the student groups on campus at the University of Oregon who pick and choose some of the films to see.
All right. So how do we get in contact with you and Disorient Asian Film Festival?
Sure. The Disorient has a website, disorientfilm.org, all of our contact information is on there. Pamela Kwan and myself, we even have our cell numbers on there.
And we can purchase tickets through the website.
Yes. Okay. Everything is, you can be purchased through the website. Yeah, the website is all up and current. All the films are listed with their exact time slots and so on and so forth. And let me just kind of give you an outline of how it's going to look. We starts Friday night.
And this is April 10th through the 13th.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Friday, actually Thursday night the 10th for one film screening, but that's special. So the film festival officially starts on the 11th with one film. And then on the 10th, we have shorts during the day. And then some features into the early evening. And then on Sunday, the same kind of thing, shorts and some features during the day, then followed by the closing film. And then on Sunday evening, we also have the awards, because we give out four awards. And it's a reception. And it goes fairly late. The same with Friday night, we have an opening night reception, and all of this, the receptions are free to the people who come. The only cost involved is if you buy a ticket or if you buy the VIP pass.
Okay, great. So thank you everyone for joining us here today on APA Compass with Ensemble Executive Director of Disoriented Asian American Film Festival of Oregon. So remember to get your tickets, and I hope to see all you guys there. Thank you for tuning in with Ka from APA Compass. We aired first Friday of every month at 9 a.m. Visit our APA Compass Facebook page or check out our APA Compass WordPress.com for past podcasts. Until next time, again, we meet. I'm out. So have a great April.
Thank you, Ka.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Yeh, and it's my pleasure today to speak with author Susan Choi. Susan Choi has won much acclaim for her first three novels. She's a winner of the Asian American Literary Award, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and a Penn Faulkner Award finalist. Her latest novel, My Education, tells the story of a young woman coming of age and takes us through the romance, the passion, the obsession, and the betrayal which she encounters in her quest for love. Susan, welcome to APA Compass.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Susan, what's your inspiration for writing the current book, My Education?
You know, I initially sort of had, I guess not a negative inspiration, but I had this desire not to do what I'd done before. So my first three novels all involved a lot of research. They're all historical in nature. They all have a little to do with politics. The first one was about the Korean War, and the second about 70s radicals. The third was about sort of a fictionalized Unabomber case. And with all these books, it had been really exciting to do the research and kind of work out the issues. And with this fourth book, I just suddenly really didn't want to write that kind of book for a change. I was, I think I was just looking for something else in terms of my process. And I just thought, I really want to write a book about people and relationships and emotions and not do a lot of research this time around. And you know, that was my initial impulse, was to write what I thought of as a smaller book about people and their relationships, mm-hmm. which ended up being a smaller book about love. And it might not be such a small book in the end.
The first three books covered a wide disparity of topics there.
I mean, each one of them came to me in a different way. Each one of them pretty easy in a different way. But to look back, you know, the first book is called The Foreign Student. And the first book is really The Foreign Student. And it's based on my father's story. My father is not my greatest country father here in the mid-50s. This is the Korean War. He came here in the 50s to become a college student. In the Deep South. So there was my Korean father in the American South in 1955, basically seeming like a Martian, I think, from the stories he used to tell about people who had really never encountered an Asian person ever. You know, he would encounter people who really didn't know where he was from or what he was at all. And I was always fascinated by that idea of my father, kind of the Martian Asian landing in the Deep South. So that was the inspiration for the first book. The second book was really different. The second book just came out of a bizarre obsession that I fell prey to about the Patty Hearst kidnapping. I one day started reading about the Patty Hearst kidnapping and couldn't stop. For a long time, I had sort of a Patty Hearst kidnapping research problem. And I discovered this very minor, quote unquote, character from the actual history of that time, Wendy Yoshimura, Japanese-American anti-war activist who had played a really footnote role in the Hearst kidnapping. And I became so interested by her because I didn't know what she was doing in that situation. And so, you know, I ended up writing a fictionalized version of that time. And the third book, it's kind of a similar thing. I'd been really fascinated by the Unabomber. I'd been fascinated by all these stories in the late 90s of the people of interest. Remember these people who the government couldn't charge them with any crime, but they'd kind of get smeared in the press anyway? And Wen Ho Lee in particular had really preoccupied me. I had followed his case closely. So, you know, in all three of those cases, something out of, you know, history, recent or not so recent, had kind of grabbed my attention. But with this book, I, you know, to be frank, also, I'd had a second child, and my appetite for doing historical research was really blunted by sleep deprivation.
No, I understand. I've got two kids of my own.
So. Yeah, you know how it is.
And your books have been coming out every 5 years or so, it seems. Are you on a certain personal timeline?
Isn't that weird? You know, with every single publication, I've sworn that I would get a book out sooner, and I just can't seem to do it. I keep hitting this 5-year cycle, you know, to the point that I'm going to just have to embrace it. It's completely unintentional. But yeah, the first one's 98, then 03, then 08, now 13. Yeah, it's like this weird circadian rhythm of productivity. It just keeps happening this way.
Do you actually write for the whole 5 years?
No, God. If I wrote for the whole 5 years, well, I wouldn't. Hopefully I'd finish sooner. You know, a big chunk of that time in every case has been spent searching for the next story. Despite constantly wanting to do otherwise, I never seem to wrap up a book with an idea already in my pocket for the next book. I kind of get entirely taken up with the one project, and then when I'm done, I'm kind of depleted, like the well is just dry. And after Person of Interest, which I actually completed in 06, although it didn't publish until 08. That was my publisher's decision, but, you know, that kept things on this every 5-year clock. There were really a couple of years there where I did not know what the next book would be. I just couldn't find it. And that's always a really hard time. I've tried to just embrace it and kind of be like, this just seems to be the pattern. But it's always very nerve-wracking.
You have any tricks for getting through that block there?
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily work, but my only trick is to just keep writing. And I, in that period, just wrote every day. And, you know, after a while, at the early part of that period, I was writing something. I actually did write the better part of a book before this book. And, you know, about 200 pages into it, it became very clear that it wasn't what I was working on, and I set the whole thing aside. But I think that was my way of finding the book that I actually was supposed to write. So yeah, a lot of kind of slogging and wasting of what feels like a wasting of time, but I know it's not wasted time. Mm-hmm. You know, I know even though these pages just don't see the light of day, like I think they are the way you end up getting to the pages that do.
As I was reading my education, I kept noticing that the protagonist, Regina Gottlieb, she shares many traits with you. I mean, both of you attended a prestigious upstate New York school in the early 90s to pursue writing. Both of you are similar ages, you're mixed race, you live in New York City, you have sons. So to what extent is Regina modeled after your own life, doing things that you've done or maybe things that you've thought about doing?
Pretty much only to the extent that you've mentioned. Actually, she's studying to be an English professor, which is not what I am. But I did borrow that from my own experience as well, because I did go through a period where I thought that I was going to get a doctorate in English and be an English professor, and that didn't pan out. And it doesn't pan out for Regina either. So there are a lot of ways in which this protagonist, in her sort of broader outlines, is sharing a lot of biographical information with me. Inside the broad outlines, there's a lot of differences, but I won't go into specifics, except to say that I really enjoyed this protagonist, because I feel like in my other books, there's been a large amount of me, but much better disguised in each of my protagonists. And there was a bit of relaxing in just writing a story about a woman who's basically my age and kind of shares my background. I have to say, although Regina is biracial, and that's very briefly mentioned, her mother does make an appearance in this book, and her mother could not bear less of a resemblance to my own mother, just out of fairness to both women, the real one and the pretend one.
Okay. So at times, the 21-year-old Regina, she's consumed by obsession, which pushes aside any for moral qualms. And you do such a fabulous job of plotting the sexual tension and the consequences of that. So did that have roots in your own youthful experiences?
You know, I mean, not experience for experience, but in a broader sense, I think that the thing I really was interested in was the difference between being young in the way that I had come to think of it, you know, being in your early 20s and being out in the adult world for the first time, sort of responsible for yourself and your decisions, and being an adult the way I feel like I'm an adult now, homeowning parent who, you know, worries about putting money away for the college fund, stuff like that. I was struck suddenly in my own life by the feeling that I'd like arrived at adulthood finally, and that the adulthood of mine that had come before now had been kind of this adolescent adulthood. I don't even know how else to explain it. It may not be the same for everyone, but I looked back at myself in my 20s and thought, here I assumed I was so responsible and mature and wise, and I really wasn't. And the main way in which I could feel that was my relationship to kids. You know, that I'd always had a very benevolent attitude toward kids. Oh, kids, you know, they're great. I love kids. I'm going to have kids. But it was having kids that made me realize, like, how little I got it. So I really wanted to write a book about a young woman kind of passing from this one earlier stage of adulthood to the other. And I wanted to sort of think about what you gain and what you lose in that transition. And I think, you know, what you gain is circumspection and experience, obviously. But what I really wanted her to lose was a certain quality of recklessness and kind of short-sightedness and passionate commitment that, at least in my own experience, is a lot easier to keep hold of when you're young. You know, even things like politics. I mean, this was kind of what American Woman was about, was being able to be totally politically committed in the face of all sorts of contradictions to your position, and then, you know, getting a little older and thinking like, oh, I don't know, oh, I'm really worried the Occupy movement, like, they're not being coherent enough. Like, you know, I remember in my 20s, I didn't care if the Occupy movement was being coherent enough. And then you get older and you start having all of these sort of circumspect worries and frets about it. So yeah, I wanted, in a way, Regina to be kind of amoral and passionate and naive, you know, and to make serious mistakes. That's kind of what I wanted to show her doing. And I wanted her older self to look back and be kind of appalled at the way she behaves, but also kind of wistful, you know, because like that version of herself that could do those things, it isn't there anymore later on.
I really enjoyed that contrast between the 21-year-old Regina who, she wanted to be older and, you know, settle down, versus the middle-aged mom, Martha, that's there, who wanted to shed her responsibilities and become 21 again, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny, too, because, you know, originally the book's concerns were really about that 21-year-old version of life and that older, that middle-aged version of life. And I didn't necessarily, definitely didn't originally conceive of this as a love story between those two versions of life, if that makes sense. I put Regina in this world and started populating it with people, and and had all these, you know, had all these sort of issues that I wanted to get into. But I pretty quickly realized that that conflict that you've just mentioned between, you know, the reckless 21-year-old who actually sort of wants to be more settled because she feels like she'll be taken more seriously as a person, and the older woman who feels incredibly restrained and constrained by her settled life. She just wants to cut loose. That contrast was actually going to work well if it was explored through a relationship between the two of them and not the relationship that you initially think is going to happen in the book.
I also love how complex your characters are, you know, how they coexist or their contradictions. And how do you strike the right balance there between, you know, a character that's not too simple and not too complex?
It's really hard, actually. Thank you for saying so, first of all, because I think that, you know, the biggest concern for me is always keeping the character such that the reader can still empathize with them and can still, you know, feel real engagement in their fate, can still really feel invested in what's going to happen to them and doesn't just get totally turned off. And I know that, you know, in early drafts, I mean, there was an early draft in which people, you know, the small handful of people that I'm lucky enough to be able to show my stuff to when it's in rough condition to get their feedback, people just hated Martha. I mean, they just thought she was, I don't even know what words I can use on this show, but they thought she was a vampiric, heartless, kind of blood-sucking. Like, people just had very visceral negative reactions to her, and I wanted her complex, but I didn't want her to be hateful. And so I really had to go back to the drawing board because I was like, what am I doing? How am I depicting this woman in such a way that people have no sympathy for her at all? You know? And even so, I mean, I think that she's very sympathetic. And, you know, my problem is that I fall in love with all my characters, even the really indefensible ones. And, you know, by the time I'm done with a book, I think that they're all like, you know, I'm very attached to them. So, I'm not sure how I did. You know, so I know some readers, a few readers in my life, are still kind of mad at Martha, which is okay. You know, by the same token, in early drafts, there were people who hated Regina. They thought that Regina was just way too irresponsible and they didn't relate to her. And, you know, I don't ever think that characters have to be nice or likable or good to be good characters. In fact, I think that often, you know, they're less interesting if they are all those things. But I do think that they have to hold the reader's sympathy. So that was a constant struggle, making these characters as complicated as I wanted them to be without, like, losing the reader and having readers go, ugh, I don't want to read about these women.
Mm-hmm. So Asian American literature has really evolved over the generations, you know, perhaps mirroring the experience of Asian Americans in the U.S. So do you have any favorite Asian American writers, you know, maybe from past generations as well as from the contemporary generation?
Oh, I have so many favorites. I mean, it has evolved so much, and it's kind of amazing to think back, because I feel like just yesterday I was, you know, in a reading group where we were sort of assembling the list of the books that we felt like we had to read to kind of familiarize ourselves with Asian American literature. And the list was so short. I mean, I'm sure there were more things than were on our list, but, you know, you did really feel like, you know, you could hit Woman Warrior and Donald Duck and, you know, No-No Boy and sort of, you were kind of covering a lot of ground there, and now you just can't say that anymore at all. And but I have real favorites from kind of what you'd call that earlier period, I guess. Like, No-No Boy remains a hugely important book to me. I really love that book. I love Dog Eaters and reread Dog Eaters every few years by Jessica Hagedorn. It's like one of my favorite books, so vibrant. I love everything by Chenry Lee, who I'm like honored to teach with when I'm at Princeton. I love his work, and I feel this strong sense of identity with Chang. You know, I feel like we both, we're both these American writers, but we do have this tie. I think his is even deeper or wider than mine because, you know, I'm half Korean and I have this other sort of unruly Jewish half that kind of confuses the whole heritage. But yeah, like countless writers and so many contemporary writers that I admire so much. You know?
Can you name a few of the contemporary ones as well?
Oh my God, you're putting me under so much pressure. I feel
if
like
you don't
that starts getting into the world of like friends of mine. And if I name one,
okay,
I'll forget another. And I love them all. I love you all.
Has being a Asian American or mixed race influenced your career decisions or direction?
You know, I appreciate my dad more and more. And I should say at this point, give a shout out to my dad, who is a Korean, recently retired professor of mathematics, who never once tried to make me do anything in particular professionally. He was so amazingly kind of supportive and hands-off at the same time. I understand as an adult now better than I ever understood when I was young how unique that was. I mean, I have so many Asian peers who will say that is so unusual that you grew up with, you know, an Asian dad who didn't try to nudge you into any particular profession. While at the same time, I have to say that I knew that my dad expected excellence from me. And he really instilled that from an early age. I knew that he expected me to excel in school, maybe to gain a higher degree. But beyond that, you know, I remember the day I called my dad and told him I was dropping out of a PhD program, and I was terrified. I thought he would be so disappointed. And he was proud. He said, "Honey, you know, if that's what you think you need to do, that's fine." He was just completely behind me. But, you know, there was never that pressure to, like, go to law school, go to med school, you know, do something lucrative. I mean, my God, you know, going into fiction writing, like, what could be less, what could be less promising? The fact that there was, on the one hand, this expectation of achievement, and on the other hand, this total openness. Do whatever it is that you want to do, just go do it really well. But it can be whatever you want. That was a really great set of kind of pressures and freedoms to, like, grow up with.
Susan Choi, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks. I enjoyed it.
We've been chatting with award-winning author Susan Choi. My name is Andrew Ye, and thanks for listening to APA Compass. The music is from Dal Strum's album, Everything That Blooms Wrecks Me.
Why the heart bends is anyone's guess. It's been so long since I felt this. Trembling a mess, strong and so bold. Take me slow. It takes so much to hold me. All around me are familiar faces, worn out places. Worn out faces, bright and early for the daily races.
This is Luann Aldoso, and you're listening to APA Compass. Today, I'm speaking with Kim Fu, author of the novel For Today I Am a Boy. The story focuses on Peter Huang, given the name Powerful King by his Chinese immigrant father, in hopes of achieving the dream of obtaining Western masculinity. His three sisters all find ways to escape the emotionally abusive home of their parents, and though Peter's dad had crowned him the exalted son, Peter has always known that deep down, he is a girl. I'm honored to be speaking with Kim today to talk about her debut novel. What inspired you to write this book?
Long before I ever thought about writing this novel in particular, I saw a story in the LA Times about a sports writer named Christine Daniels. A very particular and ultimately tragic life, but the one detail that stuck with me is that she didn't transition until she was in her 50s. So she lived and wrote as Mike Penner for, you know, over 50 years. And I couldn't get that out of my head for quite a while. Just the everyday conflict of that, of, you know, for over 50 years, like that's a full life, and that was a life that really interested me. And the other half of it was that I have older sisters myself, and they're quite a lot older than me, so I wasn't around for their awkward adolescent period. So from my perspective, they were just these grown women who had always been, you know, incredibly beautiful and confident and smart and perfect and grown up. And I think it sort of skewed my perception of femininity when I was a kid. It made it seem really unattainable and mysterious and sort of inscrutable. And for most of my life, I felt like it just was not something I could achieve. Just all this, the mystery of like the little artifices of, you know, how you walk and how to put on makeup, and it all just seemed impossible, so I wasn't even going to try. Those two feelings kind of meshed together into what became like the first little kernel that became the book.
Take me through the process of developing the characters for this book.
From the very beginning, the whole family came together. The first version of this was actually a short story, but there was never just Peter, who's the main character. I never had just Peter, and then I had to build up the rest around him. The entire Huang family came all together, all at once, particularly the four sisters and their relationships and the different experiences they have of womanhood. And it was those family dynamics that dictated everything else, from the setting and the year it's set and the year they were born, and then ultimately the trajectory of their entire lives, even as they move out and apart from each other.
And were any of the events in the book inspired by any of your life experiences?
Well, I mentioned the feelings I had with my older sisters. There are a few little pieces, too. I mean, I used to work as a restaurant cook, which Peter does, for several years. Mm-hmm. I spent my young adulthood in Montreal, as Peter does. And I think some of my experiences with race are actually best reflected, or most reflected, by the father character, which is a little strange to say because he's kind of an unsympathetic character. He's an emotionally abusive father and husband. And of course, my experiences differ from the father character because we are different generations and he's a first generation immigrant. The problem he has is a problem I had for a long time, because I grew up in a very diverse neighborhood with a very high immigrant population. And I believed for way longer than most people do in sort of the dream of a post-racial North America, you know, that the color of your skin didn't matter, and that you could, you know, you could set your identity for yourself, and that was the path to success, which is obviously untrue. When I became an adult and I moved away from that community, it was really shocking to me to go through the world and meet all these people for whom my being Asian was the first thing they saw and was extremely salient, you know, all the time, and was what they wanted to talk about and how they perceived me. And just, you know, that you cannot make your own identity, like how other people, you know, you have to navigate other people's expectations your whole life. And I think a lot of the trouble and like the great conflict for the father character in the book is that belief that he can make himself white, he can will himself white, and then everything will be different after that, and that it's ultimately impossible, and it's destroying him a little bit.
You mentioned that when you left your hometown, your diverse hometown, mm-hmm. is when you recognized how people view difference in that interpretation. What was that experience like for you, just like as you, and then how did that correspond into your writing as well?
Well, I think most people go through that much earlier. I think most people, that happens when they're, you know, they're still a child, like someone says something racist to them, and then it makes them realize the world they live in. But for me, it didn't really click in until I was, you know, 18 years old, which is very old for that to happen. So that experience made me actually take up an interest at that point in Asian culture and Asian American culture in a way I hadn't before, because I realized that was going to be part of my life whether I liked it or not, and was going to be something I had to navigate, and I needed to know what was behind these sudden questions. I think a lot of the experiences I had, they're very cliche, and they're experiences that most Asian Americans would be familiar with, but they were very shocking to me because I was encountering them for the first time so late in life.
Or would you say that this work would inspire activists, do you think?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. It is important to me to support other Asian American and Asian Canadian artists and writers, and I do feel part of a community now, and I do feel certain responsibilities to that community, and I reserve activists for people who are fighting much more directly on the ground and who are sort of doing more than I'm doing. I think I'm just trying to, you know, be a responsible member of the community. I'm not necessarily fighting for the community, and I really do appreciate the people who do that.
I'm also fascinated with the portrayal of gender and the internal conflict between masculinity and femininity in the book, especially within Peter's character. Are aspects of yourself found within any of the characters, or even Peter himself? I think you touched on this a little bit earlier.
I did. I talked about how a lot of my experiences with race are reflected in Father's character. Peter obviously has a much more extreme experience than I do, but I do have sort of a more complicated gender identity. I'm hesitant to describe myself as genderqueer because there's a certain degree of... There are experiences that go with that label and a certain degree of oppression that comes with those labels. Like, I haven't had those experiences, and, you know, I have a relatively easy time moving through the world on that front. For me, it's more of a... It's more internal. It's sort of a question of how I feel in the world and how I relate to other people.
What's a message that you want your readers to take away from the book?
I think when people finish my book, I hope that they feel entertained first. I think that's your first responsibility as an artist, and everything else is second to that. Well, not all artists, but that's how I feel about my book. But I also hope that people come away with a greater sense of empathy, and that whatever conversations it starts, hopefully about the way different identities intersect, are done in a more empathetic way. And I also think that a big part of the book for me is the joy of self-knowledge. And, you know, I think people our age and in our generation are criticized a lot for spending so much time thinking about themselves and so much time, you know, writing about themselves and posting about themselves, and our whole lives are this, you know, great big narcissistic exercise. But I do think that this is a really great time to live right now. Like, the era we live in is a great time to live in because people spend more time thinking about themselves and who they really are and what they want and what they need in the world to be comfortable. And that having those thoughts and really considering that deeply prevents a lot of suffering and ultimately will create a better world.
What's one piece of advice that you have for other aspiring writers, artists like yourself, that, because I know this is your first debut novel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what kind of advice do you have for others, even specifically within the Asian American or Asian Canadian community?
The advice I have more generally is to get to know other people, to meet other writers and editors and be out and involved. It's really hard to make it as a writer or to move forward at all if you're just writing alone in your house and, you know, sending out submissions in envelopes. And not only will it improve your writing and, you know, enrich your life to know other writers, it really will speed it up. Mm-hmm. more than anything else that you mm-hmm. can do. Mm-hmm. For Asian American writers in particular, I think it's important to know that you can't evade that label. I know some writers do choose not to identify that way, and because they want to avoid being pigeonholed. They want to say, you know, I write about what I write about, race is in it or it's not in it. But that is still how you're going to be approached, and it would be much worse to not be prepared for that. Of course, we're all unique individuals, but we share experiences because other people inflict those experiences on us. You know, whether you like it or not, you are part of a community, and you do wear that label, and you do have to accept the responsibilities that come with that label.
Thank you again to author Kim Fu for speaking with us today. For more information about her novel, For Today I Am a Boy, and her other works, visit kimfu.ca. This is Luann Algoso for APA Compass.
Children waiting for the day.
Thank you for tuning in to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. The APA Compass Collective would like to thank our guests, Kim Fu, Susan Choi, and Anselmo Villanueva. Don't forget to check out the Disorient Asian American Film Festival at the Bijou Art Cinemas in Eugene, April 10th through the 14th. APA Compass is a collectively produced program airing every first Friday of the month from 9 to 10 a.m. right here on 90.7 FM, KBOO Community Radio. You can listen and download segments of our program at apacompass.wordpress.com. You can also find archived segments of the program at www.kboo.fm/APA Compass. We also invite our listeners to join our Facebook page for any questions, comments, or segment ideas.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:57 a.m. Thank you for tuning in to APA Compass. Coming up, Air Cascadia, Flashpoints, It Takes a Village, and Radio Zine. We'll hear from Chris Andre. We'll hear from journalist Robert Perry on the IMF and Nora Barrows-Friedman with the Electronic Intifada podcast. We'll hear from Shahid Hamid on It Takes a Village, and Jimmy Tardy on the Radio Zine. And will we hear from you at kboo.fm, where you can become a member of KBOO when you click where it says Donate Today. And now this.
morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, April 4th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. We have Steve Horn back today to talk about a very strange situation regarding fracking, as always, and many of these issues, whether they are covered by mainstream media on the right or mainstream media on the left. And yes, Virginia, there is such a thing as left mainstream media, but in many cases, fracking is a stellar example among many. There are aspects to the story, to the question, to the issue that go unnoticed and unremarked upon, uninvestigated. Steve Horn has taken the trouble to look deeply into this issue and found an angle that most people have missed, but it's critical to understanding the corruption at the heart of fracking, also how the recent regrettable Supreme Court decision unleashing flood of money into the political system, that of course comes with a lot of favors. There's a lot of payback that's going to happen, and the deregulation of everything, and I do mean fracking when I say everything, this money is going to create obligations, and those obligations are going to be fulfilled. That is why it is important to understand this. So we've got Steve waiting just one more moment. We have a couple of headlines that we need to get through. It is important. On the higher learning and hiring labor issue, Portland State University received notice yesterday that the American Association of Universities, University Professors, which represents faculty, could go out on strike as early as April 16th, right after tax day. Despite the strike notice, the university and the union are going to take up negotiations again today to try to reach an agreement on faculty pay and other contract issues. A little bit further afield, Colorado rejected a proposal that would have allowed people to shoot unmanned flying objects. That's right. This was created by a chap in protest of the federal plan that would allow drones to fly in civilian airspace over Colorado. The location where this gentleman resides is a population of 586. There was 188 total votes cast. The proposal was defeated, which is strangely coincidental with the recent Precision Agriculture Expo here in Yamhill County that wrapped up yesterday. What the expo amounted to, in actuality, was a trade show for drones, nothing to do with growing anything. Precision agriculture is tiny little plots of land that are specifically tailored for specific crops. Anyone who practices precision agriculture knows it. If drones were to be any use whatsoever, it would have to fly 2 or 3 inches above the ground and be capable of testing the soil's nutrients, chemistry, as well as temperature and water content. Let's see you do that. And what if the National Security Agency knows it is violating the Constitution by spying on everyone without showing a judge probable cause? What if the massive spying had come about because the NSA found it too difficult to follow the Constitution? And what if the Constitution was written to keep the government off the people's backs, but the NSA, the President, and certain members of Congress have put the NSA not only on our backs, but in our bedrooms, kitchens, telephones, and computers right now listening? What if when you look at your computer screen, the NSA is looking right back at you? That's the world that we live in right now. All the talk of the Constitution, the Federalists, and so forth on the right, all of this pretty much obsolete now, as we live in a very different state. And it gets curiouser and curiouser with the NSA's and outweighing the Constitution's means, and the last nail pounded in the democracy's coffin, America seems poised at the fulcrum, about to become a very different animal. And just a heads up, all of this, and I do mean all of it, traced back to the USA Patriot Act, which no one believed would still be in force, and it is. And most people, not only have they forgotten that it shouldn't even exist right now, but don't know that it exists. They continue their lives under this vast shadow. But Maryland's legislators would like to outlaw the boycotts against Israel, boycotts that are rising all around the world on all sides in the face of the 21st century's most egregious example of apartheid. One great voice against apartheid rises above the cackle, and that is, of course, the voice of Bishop Desmond Tutu. The news coming out of occupied Palestine continues to shake the walls of silence that the world is hunched behind. There's more, but we have Steve Horn and a very interesting situation with fracking. Good morning, Steve. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, good to be back. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. So what? This is a story that somehow is either being ignored or flown beneath the radar. Can you talk a little bit about your recent investigation into the wild blue, as it were?
So first of all, there's a big premise that this whole debate over gas exports has really not been covered all that much, even compared to things like surveillance or lots of NSA stuff. But